This episode is sponsored by Foil Sessions, the foiling app that lets you track all your foiling sports. This is Up on Foil, the podcast for everyone flying just above the surface.
Pump, carb, soar, let's foil!
So welcome to episode number 60 of Up on Foil, the podcast where we talk all about foiling. And usually I introduce myself and the guest. And I thought, well, James Casey doesn't need no introduction. But then I talked to some people here. He's like, I'm going to have a podcast with James Casey. And they're like, who is this? So still a little introduction. I, for myself, I'm an average foiler, dock starter mostly, sometimes on the para wing as well, trying to get that downwind going. And with me, James Casey, ocean athlete, MTO champion, I don't know how many times Australian champion in SUP. And I don't know if you still have the world record of longest downwind foiling. We're going to talk about that. That of two kids, I think, or as far as I found out. Is there anything else, James, that you need to add or correct me if I was wrong?
Oh, no, that's all correct. And yeah, definitely there's a lot of people that don't know me. I feel like, so definitely the intro is worthy. I guess the only thing is, Code Foil's owner, I guess. That's one of the bigger adventures I've been on the last few years. And yeah, that's one of four riders, and that's the only thing you missed, I reckon.
All right, good. Very good. Because we're going to talk all about that, but I just like get a little story of you first, especially for those people who don't know you. You've been on a SUP for a long, long time, then kind of switched to foiling. And was supping the first water sport you did, or were you, when you were smaller, like surfing or even sailing or something?
So I grew up surfing. Surfing was the first water sport. I guess I, you know, surfing, body surfing, bodyboarding, all that sort of stuff as a kid. Both my parents surfed, so that was how I got into the ocean, the water sports. I then actually got into, my dad windsurfed a bit, so did a bit of windsurfing as a kid, just family stuff, no races or anything like that. And then windsurfing, kite surfing happened. And then actually got into stand-up paddleboarding because I sprained my ankle pretty bad on a holiday. And the only way to get back in the ocean was to go on a SUP, because I couldn't pop up when I was surfing. It re-sprained my ankle, whereas on a SUP I could still ride waves. That was why I got into SUP in the first place. And yeah, it led on to, I guess the whole sort of, I guess you'd call it a career in, you know, racing and surfing stand-up paddleboards.
Very nice. I'm very interested in how you manage your career, because as far as I know, you live for and from water sports, but still on that SUP, those were those huge long boards, right? How long are these boards? How heavy are they? I cannot imagine.
Yeah, so there's, I guess there are kind of three different disciplines that I did in the SUP, which seems like a lot. But there was SUP surfing, which is, you know, the boards are from kind of the ones I used were as short as 7 foot and as long as 10 foot. And they were basically big surfboards that you used with a paddle. And then there were race boards. They were either 12, 6 or 14 feet. And they were what we raced on, with in and out through the waves or with a flat water course or a downwind course. And then there was like, yeah, open ocean crossing sort of stuff. And on those boards, we're on unlimited, so you could use as long as you wanted. And we kind of landed on 18 feet for most of the boards that I raced on. And they're basically surf skis, essentially, but you stand up on them. And they're, look, they're, because we're racing on them, they're not that heavy. Like, we're probably looking at, well, they're probably, to be honest, they're probably lighter than a full foil setup that we're using now. Wow. Yeah, so even though they're big boards, foam's light, and it's the outer, you know, carbon fiber or resin or, you know, whatever your outer skin that's heavy. So I think the boards that I was racing, 6-7 kilos kind of thing. Okay. for big boards. So they were.
But when I think about racing, you also like have to move. Yes, if you have a car, you put it on the roof, but flying is not possible with these things. You have to ship those.
Seriously. Yeah. So there was definitely a time where we could fly with them, 12 sixes for sure, 14 footers sometimes. Sonova actually came up with a pretty cool two-piece model where you had 2 7-foot parts and you could take them apart, fly with them and, you know, put them back together, which I used a couple of times, but obviously the board's going to be heavier because of the engineering to keep them together. And I actually raced, there was a Red Bull heavy water event in San Francisco, and it was like, you know, 10-foot waves paddling out through the beach at Ocean Beach. And I used a two-piece for that, which was a pretty cool, I guess, promo for the board. It actually broke at the leg rope, the leash plug. There were two leash plugs, but they weren't glassed in like heavy enough. They, like, the only thing that broke was the leash plugs. And like, okay. it was a 10-foot wave in the head and had to bail. So the leg rope didn't break, the board didn't break, but the leash plug broke, and I had to swim all the way and grab a board and paddle back out, which was a bit of a pain. But if, you know, I said to them, the board worked good, just can you make these leash plugs a bit stronger? Because of all things, that was the thing that broke.
Do you still go on these boards, or are you just doing nothing but foiling?
It's a good question. I'm actually just sort of moving houses and going through the garage of all the gear, and pretty much everything. And doing a bit of a cull of what I do and don't use. And it's definitely down to a bit of a skeleton crew of the remaining boards. So there was at one point, you know, 10 sort of surf sups, 6 race boards. And I think I've culled it down to like 3 surf sups and maybe 4 surf sups and 3 race boards, which is still too many for how much I'm doing it. But, you know, I want to still be able to, you know, go out surfing with my son, and the stand-up paddle boards are good to take out, you know, as like big surfboards. And then the race boards, sometimes I go paddling on the lake, and it's really good fitness going for a paddle on the lake, as is foiling. But sometimes it's good just to mix it up. So I do have, yeah, still a few boards. Culled it to 1 18-footer, 1 14-footer, and 1 12-6, which is way too many, but I still have it. And
some discussions with the family then, what you're allowed to
exactly.
keep.
Exactly. Yeah, seriously. But yeah, it's a balancing act. And even if you don't use them for a year, I still feel like I'm going to use them at some point. But,
yeah, plus with the kids,
I still really love them all. So it's just finding time to get out and do it.
Yeah, and you can always bring the argument with the kids, because I imagine going out with these boards with the kids is still fun.
Oh, so much fun. And the dugout boards, like the 18-footer, you can have, like, you know, I haven't done it yet, but I've had one of them in, but you could easily have the two kids in there and you go for a paddle on the lake, and it's kind of like being out there in a boat, which is pretty sick.
Very nice. How old are your kids?
3 and 1. So they're, my 3-year-old comes surfing with me, he sort of holds onto my neck, and we paddle into waves, and sometimes just lie down on the waves, other times he wants to stand up, and it's just, you know, just getting him, trying to get him comfortable out in the ocean and enjoying that. And the 1-year-old's running down to the shoreline and then putting her feet in and then running back. And she's a goer, but she's not quite able to hold onto my neck just yet. And the water in the face she doesn't like. So just taking it slow with him, and don't want to push him into it, but I definitely want to expose them to little parts of it.
Exactly. I was on vacation with the family as well a couple of days ago, and my 6-year-old, she also like grabbed me around the neck, and she was like in my little backpack, and I went on foil with foil drive, which she loved, just like cruising around and like taking some little bumps. Super amazing. And she wanted to go forever, even though she was shivering. So cool, man. Yeah. So then eventually foiling arrived. Do you remember? Oh, sorry, I'm balancing here on my balance board. That's why I move a little bit. Do you still remember how it was when you saw foiling for the first time? And were you opposed to it? Or you thought immediately, that's something I want to try as well?
No, I remember seeing it on social media when, I think, Kyle Lenny posted that video. And I was in Mary at the time, and I actually remember seeing him behind him in the Pioneer lineup, and you know, the board was there and the foil was all covered up, and we followed him. We're going past Hookeeper and Maliko Gulch anyway, so we stopped at the top and watched him paddle out and watched him paddle up on the foil, and we're like, it is real. Like, it's not, you know, it's not just, you know, video tricks. But yeah, I remember seeing that, and I guess not the first time I'd seen foiling, because obviously the strapped crew over in Maui, those videos were doing the rounds, we saw that, and it just seemed so out there and far-fetched, I guess, jet skis and snowboard boots, and didn't really, was still interesting, but it was like, this wasn't available. And then, when you saw Kai, and then, it looked awesome, you know, it looked unreal. And to me, it was kind of an extension of what I was doing anyway, which was racing the unlimited boards downwind, and downwinding on a stand up, you know, was at the time that I was doing it, was like sold as you're surfing down the coast, you know, and that was the closest you could be doing to it. But now there's foiling's just a better version of it, in my opinion.
Very nice. Very nice. So if something like that, if foiling would arrive just now, everyone would think that is AI. Because when the first time I saw someone in a breaking wave with a foil, I thought, "Man, that looks fake. It doesn't look real." That's crazy.
Seriously. Yeah.
And now it's just here. How is it for you when you like decide, all right, I want to try this thing, and went up on foil? Do you remember that feeling? How difficult was it for you? Because you were a very good paddler.
It was really hard. I managed to get a go foil very early on. I guess it was probably September, October after Kai Lenny released that video downwinding on that chopped off race board. And so 2015 or 2016, I think it was. And it just seemed like all your instincts were back to front. You know, as it got steeper, you had to lean further forward. But from surfing, if you lean further forward, you get a nosedive. So you had to lean further back. And, you know, so, and then when it was flatter, you had to lean further back, not lean further forward. So everything was back to front. And I remember going out with Jake Jensen and Vinicius Martins, who were sup racing with. We'll stay in the accommodation together. And it was just, we had one board between the three of us, and we just swapped between us. Like, we'd all have a go and for like a week. And I think we all got like one good wave by the end of the week, and we were totally hooked. We had to give the gear back to Alex. And the first, you know, as soon as I get back, I'm like, I'm only giving it back if you can tell me where, you know, when I can get one, you know. So I put a deposit down for that sort of right away. It's actually, I think I got some prize money for one of the events from the SUP, and I actually put it straight towards a foil, and it was definitely the best investment I've ever made, I reckon. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, now you're working full in that. That is really good. Cause I looked at your podcast that you have, and you were podcasting even before I was foiling. So that's really like, you've seen it all. That's crazy. But
yeah,
like in the
but
last
I haven't done as many episodes. As you yet.
Yeah, you've been, I'm just talking, you're actually foiling, which is way, way better. Let's maybe talk about your life now as a, like you just said, you work with code, you do these, the videos, you have the the Coach Casey program. Where else are you involved? How do you finance yourself with foiling?
Yeah, it's kind of threefold, I guess. I've got the easiest one to explain is Recode Foils. I'm, you know, part owner in that, and basically three mates and I put money in to develop a foil and a brand, and that's what Code Foils is now. So it's been a pretty cool adventure, and that's, you know, we spent a lot of time developing, distributing, even just, you know, QCing, just the day-to-day thing of running a foil business, which it's a lot of, it's not as much foiling as you'd think, but it does include foiling. So that's one part of it. And then the other part is, I guess, before foiling even started, I was coaching stand-up paddleboarding, and before that I was actually coaching kite surfing. So coaching's been a big part of my career, and has allowed me to do what I do, because sponsorship dollars was never really enough for me, not in Australia anyway. So the Coach Casey Club is like an online coaching platform, and it started for stand-up paddle racing, and with the explosion of foiling and my passion for foiling, it became, you know, more of a foil thing. And while there is still SUP sort of race stuff in there, it's now pretty dedicated to foiling. Includes weekly coaching calls that I call Talk Back Tuesday. It's a Tuesday coaching call. There's a Facebook page, and there's a bunch of online courses that I've basically, it was a COVID project. I had all this, I guess, information that I had stored up, but I couldn't do lessons. So I'm like, oh, I got to write on the stuff that I, like my kind of lesson plan or guides or timelines for learning and how it's done and the steps. Let's write it down. Let's film it and let's put it online and see how it goes. And that's now probably takes up most of my time. I still sort of create videos each sort of week that updates courses, and when there's new disciplines that come out, like parawinging or foil assist or whatever it is, I update the course. And I'm actually working on the foiling fundamentals course, which is kind of like a, I guess it, the problem with just a downwind course or just a parawing course is people who aren't into downwinding or parawing don't look at it. To me, surf foiling, duck foiling, flat water foiling, dock starting, they all have the same fundamentals. The foiling fundamentals course has been a really good one. I had a lot of really good feedback from members on that. stance, equipment choice, pumping, it's all an important part of foiling. So that's the Coach Gacy Club.
Yeah.
And then the third part, I guess I do, I guess it's lessons or retreats. So I do private lessons, private coaching, and the retreats are like a, you know, over in the Motu or the Maldives or...
The Fiji one that you just did.
Yeah, the Fiji. Yeah,
which Josh is going to talk about that as well. Nice.
Yeah. So, and that's kind of the third sort of, it kind of crosses over between the Coach Casey Club stuff and the Code Foil stuff, because sometimes people come and they want to try different gear, and sometimes they just want to learn heaps and work on their foiling. But it's the retreats are a holiday where you're learning some, you know, cool things and doing some fun, you know, getting pushed a little bit outside your comfort zone, but it's all about progression and fun. So we want you to leave learning new skills and take, be able to take it home, but also have fun whilst you're living there as well.
Very nice. Yeah. So is my
son a bit noisy?
No, it's fine. It's fine. You know, I think it's super cool. I think for the audio, it doesn't matter that much. We can hear you very well. And also,
okay. That's
just what life is. I'm in my bedroom, like trying have a little studio. So that's just what it is. Like, we do what we
okay,
can.
Good. Yeah,
so you just came back from that retreat in Fiji. That was a couple of weeks ago. That was,
maybe 12 days ago. You know, not even 2 weeks. So yeah,
with Josh, how was it? It looked amazing. I mean, wow.
Yeah, Namoto is got to be one of the best places to do water sports in the world. You know, you've got three world-class foil waves each side of the island, Namoto Laughs, swimming pools, and hummus. And, like, if you've been there, if you've seen footage from those places, like, on their day, they can be all-time for foiling, but also all-time for surfing too. And then the Fijian people are just so giving, and I guess they're you know, some of the best, I guess, hospitality sort of workers I think I've dealt with. And then the probably the best thing is that the whole island is built around water sports. There's probably 10 boats, and all these boats, if you go out for a foil and the wind drops, the boat's right there. You can just jump in the boat and they can take you back to the island. Whereas some other resorts that I've been to, you don't really understand what it is you're doing. And you go out for a foil, like, what are you doing? And why are you over here? Why aren't you at the surf spot where all the surfers are? Because that's where the water sports are. The Motu, they understand that, you know, wind sports, you know, windsurfing got a long history there, kitesurfing got a long history there, and foiling. Sort of, you know, Kailani did the first that I know of, you know, double up, like double dip, I guess, jump from one wave to another. So they've seen it, and they're all about it. Just 1 second.
Yeah, sure. I was, because I saw these images, it looks beautiful. The foiling looked very, very nice, but we all know that, you know, those are nice pictures, but it is work for you as well. Like, what was your job? There's risk involved as well all the time. And how was it for you? Were you able to enjoy yourself, or was it like, no, it is work. How do you feel about that?
Look, it is work. And I definitely tell my wife and my family that, you know, because it is, have to, unless you can't get the time away. But, you know, I guess the hardest thing is you're out in conditions that are, you know, epic, and you're having to focus on the clients, which I'm not saying it's hard, you know, seeing them progress is awesome as well. And I really treat it as work. Like, when there's a good wave coming and there's a client next to me, I say, you know, you go, and they're number one priority. And if I can catch the wave with them, I'll be there, and I'll be with my camera, or I'll be on there, like, speaking to them and say, turn left, turn right, and trying to really give them all my time. If there's a wave coming and there's no one out, everyone's paddling back out, I can't help them paddle back out. So I'm going to ride a wave and, you know, show them, I guess, what I want them to be working towards, you know, is how I justify it. Is turn like this, bend your knees, you know, extend, all that sort of stuff, and even pumping back out. So, and all the clients, the people that come to the camps and do lessons with them at it, that's sort of how it operates. And they don't want me to just sit there sort of pushing them into waves or talking to them the whole time. They can only process so much at once. And to be honest, I always feel like a little tip here and there is helpful when you're out in the water, but most of the coaching is actually done back on land, looking at video analysis or going through a course or, you know, working through the fundamentals. And on the water is trying to put into practice. And when I'm on the water with them, it's trying to remind them of what we spoke about already, remind them of the little pointers that we've, you know, that we sort of discussed, and then trying to show them, open their eyes to, you know, look up instead of looking down at your feet, look up, look across, where you look, you go, little things like that. So it's, the hardest thing, I guess, is that it's hot you know, in Fiji, like the, you cover it up as best you can, but whether you're on a jet ski or in the water with them, you're in the elements. And I tell you what, some of the clients, like, they last dawn till dusk. So there's not even time to do your stuff. But sometimes they get towards the end of the week, they normally get a bit more tired, as do we as coaches. But I try to sort of carve out like 30 minutes here or there for, you know, a quick tow session or a quick foil drive session or a quick sup session, just to sort of fill my cup up in those epic conditions. But to be honest, I'm happy with half an hour of quality foil time. I don't need 12 hours of the day to sort of rip it up. I'm happy doing, you know, if there's 12 hours a day, 11 and a half hours of coaching and 30 minutes of my own foiling is awesome. And the clients are normally understanding of that. They don't expect 12 hours of coaching. That's a big day. And it's epic. You know, I'm pinching myself that, you know, I can get to call that work. And while it does definitely drain you, like your physical battery, your social battery, I wouldn't change it for the world. And but it does take me a bit of time to recover from the camps. That's all the retreats, that's for sure.
And then you're coming home and the family says, well, you've been away, now it's your time to be in charge here as well. And now with the move, that's not easy. But when I look at that foiling and you talk about the teaching, I still think, well, first you need to organize it. Was that your job as well? Or were you just like, no, I'm the coach. I have to do the things on the water and someone else is doing everything else. Because as you said, like video, like filming is one thing, but then discussing the video, then like all the socializing that goes with it. Is that part of your job as well? Or did someone else see that?
Yeah, that's part of my job too. I think I've done previous ones in the past with Moon Tours, and they did a great job sort of helping me organize flights and accommodation and getting all the clients to sign up. And I've kind of shifted towards doing it myself, because as you get more and more experience, you think, well, I can do that. And with that, I get more, if I'm going to be away and I'm earning X amount, if I do the organization beforehand as well, then I'm earning, you know, two times X amount. So it's just, you know, it's just economics, I guess. And if you can cut out the middleman, then it makes it more worth your while. And with, I guess, more a growing family, it's to get the time away, you've got to justify it. So if I can do a bit of work whilst home in organizing and then get over there and, you know, I guess make a bit more money, then it does make it more worthwhile and makes more sense. And it's been fun, but yeah, it is a bit more on your plate. But as I said before, I wouldn't change for the world. I'm living the dream for sure. And I, you know, feel so lucky that I'm in a position that I am in.
As I said, it looks beautiful. I still can't imagine how people, because foiling already is expensive. And then something like that, what was it, a week? I don't know how people pay for that. What did a place, a spot there cost when they signed up? Was that like all-inclusive flight, the bed in a hotel, food and the coaching? Or did they just sign up for the coaching and the classes?
For Nemoto, it's definitely getting more and more expensive. And I think like standard rates to just do a week on Nemoto is pretty close to like $6,500 to $7,000. Whoa. So that includes like all you can do water sports, in terms of like, you know, boat transfers, food, like breakfast, lunch, dinner, accommodation, doesn't include alcohol. But it's pretty much all inclusive. And then the coaching, we add stuff on, and then you add on jet skis and it's another cost. And yeah, pretty much by the time you add all the costs up for the coaching, you know, fees and the jet skis and photographer and all that sort of stuff, and it's getting pretty close to it's getting expensive, that's for sure. Yeah, there aren't many, I guess, coaching weeks that are happening on an Emotu that are much cheaper than like $10,000 USD. That's just the rates that it is, and it's definitely a niche market. Definitely aware of that, because not everyone can afford that. The equipment's expensive enough, travel's expensive enough, and by the time we get there, but you get what you pay for. And most people that do the week, that there's no regrets. It is, you know, it's the best. It's the best place to be. And like, obviously you can get skunked with weather, but there's just so many options. And as a foiler, you probably foil because, you know, you live in a place that if the waves are no good, you can foil, or there's no waves. And so I think going to a place like the MotoGP Crazy to not foil, because I know a lot of surfers who go there, and if the surf's no good, if the foiling's good, the surf's generally no good, and they're going fishing, which they don't even fish, or they're just hanging out in the island, not doing much. Whereas as a foiler, if the weather's good, there's no wind and there's waves, you're out there foiling or you're surfing. And if the weather's no good and it's windy, you're out there foiling. And if the weather's flat and there's, you know, that you're always doing something, you know, yeah. As a foiler, like there's not a single bit of downtime. And I was on the Moto, you know, the last week, the surf guys were always saying, you guys are working so hard, you're doing so, like so many sessions. It's like, yeah, it's always pumping for foiling. Like it's always good. It's always really good conditions for foiling. Whereas the surfing, it's good in the morning, the wind comes up, it's all over. Whereas for us, if wind's no good, if there's no wind, you're out there. If the wind comes up, they want to do downwinders. If the wind's the wrong direction, you're doing downwind the other way, or you're doing kiting, or you're doing parawinging. There's always something to be doing, and that's the beauty of it. And you're definitely getting the most out of the money spent.
That is perfect. After such an event, is usually before an event, do you have another one like planned already?
The beauty was like after or towards the end of the week, all the clients were asking, when's the next one? Which is always it's what you want, right? Like they're happy with how it went. We've got two lined up actually in Fiji for 2026 already, and potentially there will be a third. There's one we're working on at Namotu, February 15th to 22nd, and that'll be, it's a week. And then we've also got another one, which is on a boat, Fiji Surf Charter, and it's May 28th to June 4th, so it's another 7 nights, on a boat. So it's going to be a little bit different experience, able to travel to a few different locations, but also maximize your downwinding. Namotu is great for downwinding. You've got the cloud break back to Namotu. You've also got Namotu down to cloud 9. But the bay run, Namotu down to cloud 9, does get better the further you go. So with a boat, you can kind of anchor down the other end, you know, get the boat back, get a boat back up and finish back at the... So you can maximize that tail end of that run, which from Namotu, it's a bit of a bumpy boat ride back to the island. So we're excited for that. And we're looking at potentially some other dates in September, October kind of timeframe, to same as what we just had, but waiting on dates and finalizing all that.
You said that people were asking for the next one. Are there still like spots available, or is everything already sold out?
No, there's spots available. I think we've kind of just locked in that boat trip in the last week, and haven't quite locked in the 15th to 22nd, but in the process of. Still got to work out pricing and everything, because I guess everything goes up every year in every aspect. But yeah, the Moto have adjusted their pricing for 2026. So we're trying to factor that in and see where we can, what wiggle room we have to still make it as affordable as possible.
So where can the people like sign up? Where can they like ask if there's a spot available?
Yeah, if you go to my website, CaseyAus, so CaseyAus. CaseyAus.com. There's a drop down for retreats, and the retreats section is where all the information is on pricing and availability of dates and all that sort of stuff. So have a look at it there, and also you can send me an email at info@CaseyAus.com.
All right, very nice, very nice. So that's one part of your thing, the Coach Casey program as well. I talked to Jonas almost a year ago now, and he's also one of these coaches. They're probably spread all around the world. How many do you know? Do you know how many you have, or are there so many already?
I can list them off. So we've got Jonas Hillier and John Mann in Europe, and then Josh Koo, myself, and Hugh Mitchell in Australia. And then we've got, I think Zane Westwood's in there too, so five. And then what's his name in Brazil? Is there? Mizo in Brazil. I'm sure I'm missing someone, which is probably bad. We'll try and get Ryan Arzi as well, but he's busy with his own sort of stuff at the moment. I think that's probably it. So six coaches at least.
But that's just like for paddling. Do you see now the parawing kind of taking space in there as well?
Oh, for sure. Like the online coaching is definitely not just paddling. I've got a wing course in there. I've got a surf foil course in there. I'm working on a parawing course. It's interesting. I kind of thought parawing was going to eat into the paddling more than it has to date. I think, and you can kind of tell, you know, spent a bit of time in Hawaii this year, time here in Sydney. And it's interesting. It's actually, I feel, not taking away those who are learning to downwind. I'm encouraging parawing for people that are learning to downwind because I think it's a great tool. It's a lot, if there's wind, it's a lot easier to get up and going than paddling if you've got a wind sports background. But it's still, it's a hard thing to learn because you need, I guess, a certain level of the fundamentals to be able, you need to be able to pump, because if you can't pump, like when you're putting the paddling away, there's a bit on, like you've got to multitask. You've got to stay up on foil, read the bumps and put the paddling away. And that takes, it's about 30 seconds. Once you dial it in, when you don't, probably closer to a minute, and a minute of multitasking, paddling, bump reading and pumping. So it's three skills. It's hard. And you have to be a certain level of foiler to be able to do that. And I think in some ways the paddle is a more seamless, if you can paddle up, it's a more seamless, you know, paddling and pumping to then reading the bumps. And if you can do that without, you know, your heart rate being at 200, then it's actually a more seamless transition because the bumps that you're reading are the same bumps that you're riding. Whereas when you're powering, you're going from fully wind powered to packing away to now fully swell powered, I guess is how I put it. And if with the swell powered sort of stuff, it's hard, man. Like transitioning from wind to swell is hard, but the beauty of the paddling is you're learning to read the swells before you even get up. So that helps a fair bit.
Yeah. You have a lot of time like in the water and just like feeling the waves. Oh, I did hours of paddling without getting on foil. But hey, that's also like part of the process. And
well, that's you learning to read the swells is how I see it. And like you can either learn it paddling, or you can learn it whilst packing your paddling away and foiling. And unfortunately, I find that just paddling powered up, you actually won't learn anything about the swells. Like you'll learn how to read the wind, you learn how to sail, but you're not learning anything about the swells until you pack the paddling away. And packing the paddling away, before you pack the paddling away, you have to know how to elite read the swells. So it's kind of like you're going to have a lot of failures, same as you would with the paddle. But to me, I totally get it. And like one of the reasons I love the paddling is because I was doing, when I was winging, I was trying to get wingers into downwinding, and winging downwind to me is clumsy. It's another thing to manage, like your wing and your wing goes in the way, and you got to swap hands and you can't go straight downwind because the wing gets in your way.
To grab the wing back if you feel like, oh, I don't have that speed, you just take it back, and it's just a too quick, like cheap,
too easy of. It's too easy to rely to switch from swell back to wind.
Mm-hmm.
The deflate downwind was like, so my early podcast, I'd ask every guest, like, have you done a deflate downwinder yet? And it was a bit of a running joke in the end. But the deflate downwinder is essentially is parawinging. The beauty of the parawing is you can reinflate your wing a lot easier than the way I was doing it with the pump or the CO2 bottle. The deflate downwinder interestingly took off, like, kind of just after I stopped asking people about it. But it was exactly what the paddling is. Like, it's, if you can pack your wing away, then now you're downwinding and you don't have to rely, you can't rely on the wind again. You're fully committing to the swells and forgetting about the wind, which was, to me, it's exciting. And that was what the paddling is doing now.
That's what I really love, because in Switzerland, foil drive is not allowed. And then I was in the Netherlands and I went on a session with Dominic Hoskins, and that's where I really understood, all right, foil drive really helps to improve. Because, yes, of course, you can easily pull the trigger again, but you can also, like, turn it off or just let it dangle and just focus on the wave. And if you fall, it's no problem. You just get up instantly and can focus on the waves again.
Yeah.
How often do you use that when teaching?
Oh, foil drive heaps. I actually went out in the foil drive yesterday, just testing some new equipment. And, I love it. The foil drive, I probably in the last probably 3-4 years, I've used the foil drive to teach more than anything else. It's great for beginners. You can basically use it as an e-foil. It's great for sort of people who are transitioning to surf foiling from like winging or pump foiling, because you're getting them into the waves and out of the impact zone in the sort of open ocean sort of zone, the deep water, and they can get their confidence up and they can be on waves and riding. That's really good. I love it. But to me, the biggest thing I see is, similar, I guess, to what I was talking before, the transition from powered to unpowered is it's not the easiest thing. It's a skill that you've got to learn, and there's foot movements, there's positioning, there's a lot of things because you're changing speeds. There's a change of pressure on the board when you're motoring and not motoring. So that's a skill set that, like, people see foil drive or any foil assist as a shortcut. And I kind of disagree. It's not a shortcut, it's just a different avenue. You know, when you're paddling, you're learning how to paddle. And the problem with, I guess, SUP downwind foiling is you don't feel like you're doing the sport until you finally get up. And there's a lot of time before you get up. And it's not fun. Like, people struggle for a long time doing the paddle thing. And I get that. Yeah. With the foil drive, you can have fun throughout the journey, and you may not even be on foil yet. You're just e-foiling essentially with the motor in, and you're having fun doing that. You're doing the foiling. You're closer to the end goal than you are when you're off foil paddling around trying to find your balance. So that to me is, yeah, it's a hard sell teaching someone to SUP downwind foil and struggling for the first 20 sessions, you know, whereas foil drive, you can have them on foil the first session, you know, regardless of skill level. You start them in the lake and they're getting up and going. You start them in the lake with the SUP, they're not getting up for a while, you know, and they're just paddling, and they're not doing any of the foiling just yet. Yeah.
I saw that I don't know if it was a reel. I saw somewhere that you said you use a Parawing also for teaching because you can get back up.
Yeah, for sure. In Nemoto just recently, and like in, I guess in the last couple of months, I've been using the Parawing as a coaching method. When you got a group of five or six people, usually I try to work off like a one coach to three guests ratio. Mm-hmm. And
that's difficult already because one is on foil and one is not on foil, and they're far away.
Ages away. Super hard. So with the Parawing, you can literally coach the guy that's up on foil and maybe go a kilometer with him, and then say, okay, you're good, keep going, you know where you're going, and then Parawing zigzag back upwind to the guy that's at the back, help him paddling to sort of pointers to paddle, to balance, to take the right options, the right bumps, and then get back up and find the guy in the middle and do a few runs with him, and then go back out to the guy at the front. And you can be in three places at once because you can go back upwind. Whereas I've done a lot of coaching like that with just a paddle, and I normally bolt on a massive foil, like a 1300 or a 1540S, and I'll, you know, ride with the first person, and then I'll go too far and think, oh man, now I got to pump. Oh, and I'll pump back upwind to the second person and catch my breath and chat to them, and then pump back upwind to the third person, or you just run out of steam and you stop and you wait for them to come to you. But you just feel useless when you're sitting there stopping with the Parawing. Even though you're not with them whilst you're going upwind, you got eyes on them, and you can see, and you're on foil, and you can see what's going on, which is better than stopping, catching your breath after pumping upwind for 500 meters.
Did you use other technical help? Because in the last episode, which I recorded just like 2 hours ago, I talked to Jens. He built the Foil Sessions app where you can see how your downwinders went, when you went up, went downwind with a Parawing. He has also like this thing included where you can mark a little point where your goal is, so you don't miss your entrance in a bay or something, and that you can watch on your watch where to go. Do you use apps like that as well?
To be honest, there's enough going on out in the water without anything like that. Normally the most stuff I use is I use like a BB talking headset where I can talk to the client whilst we're out there. A walkie talkie with another coach. And then like I use WhatsApp sort of location tracking, which is the kind of the three most used, I guess, extras. But mobile phones, obviously, with the WhatsApp sort of location tracking. But it's hard to implement too much more. And obviously it sounds like really good, like having the watch tracking and all that sort of stuff.
You can, there's an arrow on the watch where you know, all right, I have to go this way for 3 kilometers now, so then you don't go past it.
Sometimes the conditions change, and like in a place like Nemoto, currents and winds can change 5 degrees, and all of a sudden the angle that you were going is now going kind of either towards the island, it could be into the wind, for example, or across the wind, and the current changes, that's dragged you further over towards Tabarua instead of Nemoto. And there's just things that you need communication throughout the run that's more important. Like, that's more important than the planning before the run. Almost every session you start, okay, the wind's blowing this way, we're going to start here and we're going to go that way. And even like in local runs here in Sydney, you start in one place and you say, this is what you should be doing. But throughout the run, the conditions change and your strategy has to change throughout the run. So you could be, you know, starting by going the ones into shore and then cutting out. So at the end, you might have to start the ones going out and cutting in. And it's tricky. And like, every location that I've downwind foiled, the conditions change throughout. You just got to adjust on the fly, and that's where I find the communication during the run. Wind's doing this, or the wind's dropped, or the wind's picked up. We got to come in early. We got to extend, or it's tricky for sure. But with communication, good communication on the fly, it sort of allows you to stay connected.
very nice. I just is that a bird in the background?
Yeah, we're bird sitting at my Sarah's place. Quaker nice. Parrot. Yeah.
I just want to address two more things. And one was the races that you did, and you won M2O twice, I think, 19 and 23, right? And you were back in Hawaii this year.
And then how I went in Hawaii this year.
Yeah. How was that for you? Is that something you do for code, or you just enjoy doing it yourself? Is that kind of vacation, or is that work as well? Or personal brand management, maybe?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess the less I get to the pointy end, the more it's work and brand managing. And if I'm winning, I'd put it as I'm still an athlete, you know, still working towards that. 2019, I've been doing Molokai to Oahu since, I think, well, the Hawaii season since 2015. So it's 10 years. I didn't get in the first year because it was so competitive to get in the SUP days. Then did 5 years, 2016, 17, 18, 19. Well, I guess that's 4 years. So maybe I had to get in 2015 and started 2014. Fluid. Yeah. But yeah, managed to win in 2019. And at that time, I was competing as a SUP racer and on the unlimited boards. And I did foil from, as I said, 2016, 17, 18, 19. And I would have loved to have foiled, but the foil and SUP was on at the same time. And foiling was kind of, not a sideshow, but it was it was so early in the sport that there was, I guess, more prestige in winning the SUP than it was the foil. Plus, Kyle Lenny was doing a pretty good job at winning those, and equipment and all that sort of stuff. It was I'd put too much energy into the SUP to go into the foiling. And so I was stoked that I could win it in 2019. And then COVID hit, and actually my dad had gotten pretty sick throughout that time. He had a brain tumor. And so I 2019, I sort of put towards winning it, and I dedicated my win to him, and he was still alive at the time. I gave him the poster, and we sort of celebrated that when I got home, and that was really cool. And then sort of COVID happened, and it's a lot of family time with my dad being crook, and then Molokai to Oahu didn't happen again until 2023. Throughout that time at home, I was pretty much exclusively foiling and a bit of SUP surfing, not much SUP racing because of COVID. There wasn't races going on, and 2023 everything opened up again. It was kind of really good timing for the foiling, and there's no question that I was definitely foiling in 2023, not SUP racing, because I had been doing it for so long, and I'd done that the Guinness World Record sort of longest distance thing, and I felt fit for it, and I was ready to go. And but with foil design, you could be the fittest guy out there, but if you're not on the right foil, you don't have a chance. All the foils are getting pretty close now, but in 2023, it was definitely a case of if you're on the wrong foil, you're not even going to be in the top five, regardless of how fit you are. And he even saw Kyle Lenny didn't do so well in 2023 and 2024 compared to his dominance before COVID, which it just shows it's not so much about the athlete themselves. It was a bit of an arms race going on. 2023, with the way that the course was and the conditions weren't really suited to, I guess I call it the Australian sort of conditions. Oscar and I being one and two on sort of bigger, lower foils compared to nowadays. So I guess the Aussie sort of way of downwinding because of the conditions we have was good. Since then, 24, 25, the course has been changed and it's more a point A to point B, which is awesome for the race. It's a much better downwind race. To me, I always get in trouble saying this, but it's not the true spirit of the race, because in the SUP days, M2O was always considered an ocean race, not a downwinder, because you started in flat water. There's a good downwind section for 40 Ks, and then there was a 2 kilometer upwind section. And the upwind sucks on a SUP. It sucks on a prone board, sucks on a surf ski, sucks on an outrigger canoe, sucks on everything. it also sucks in the foil. And the difference between all those things is the SUPs, the outriggers, the prones, the surf skis. You can still paddle and you're doing the same thing that you're doing in the middle of the channel as you're at the end upwind. Whereas on the foil, you're on foil in the middle and you're going so quick. You're going like 30, 40 Ks an hour in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the end, you're now going, you were going 30 to 40, you're now going about 5 Ks an hour. Whereas on the SUP, we were only going 15, 16 Ks an hour in the middle, and now we're going 8 or 9 Ks an hour at the end. So the difference is that you're going moderately fast to moderately slow. With the foil, you're going extremely fast to extremely slow. And that was the thing that I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their head around. Is it a foil race if you're paddling for the last kilometer? And I totally understand why they've changed it. It's better. It's a better spectacle finishing on foil, but it's a different race now because now we're starting in the bumps and finishing in the bumps. It's more like Maui to Molokai was always the best SUP race in the Hawaiian racing because it was bumps to bumps, more or less, but there was actually still a bit of a flat water finish at the end, 100 meters or 200 meters or something, whereas M2O is a better downwind race than M2M now, which was never the case in the SUP days because of the new course change, which is awesome for the fun and the crazy conditions, but for the history of it and my history in M2O, it's like you've moved the race to a completely different location.
All right. You just said about the Guinness World Record that you have, the over 200 kilometers on foil in 12 hours. When was that? And if you were to do it now, how much further do you think you'd come?
Yeah. I think a few people have done a lot further than me since. I think technically I still have the Guinness World Record because it's a 12 hours thing, point land to land, and it's a pain in the ass to organize a Guinness World Record with, you know, spectator. You need an official. You need officials or witnesses to sort of sign off on certain things, and it's a logistical nightmare. So whilst people have gone further, technically, I still have the record, which I think is ridiculous, but it's just the paperwork. Yeah, I think I did 213 kilometers in like 11 hours and 15 minutes, but the record in the Guinness thing was how far you can go in 12 hours, and you've got to start on land. When you take your foot off land or you jump off the headland like I did into the water, the clock starts, and when you put your foot back on land, the clock finishes. Okay. So it's more of a, you know, land to land. Just makes it super clear. You can't change foils. You can't touch the boat. It's just, you know, way you go. Whereas a lot of people have started out in the middle of the ocean and then finished in the middle of the ocean because they've run out of daylight or whatever it is. It's still epic. I mean, there's no discrediting what they've done, but it's this little box that Guinness do, and they say you got to do this, this, and this, and that's what makes it.
They somehow need to narrow it down so people can understand as well. But how much further do you think you'd come now? Because foil development is going at a pace that is incredible.
Yeah, even at the time that I did it, there was a lot more room for improvements. I used the Axis ART 1099, which is at the time it was a great foil, but even then it wasn't considered a fast foil, and it was a foil that I could go a long time for. 11 hours on. You know, in the water, foiling is not only hard on the legs, but it's hard to get the conditions that are suitable for it. And for the day that I did it, the first 3 hours were pretty much flat water. Wines would call it flat water pumping, essentially, because the wind was kind of cross offshore and the swells were like there wasn't much going on activity wise. And then a front came through, so the last 8 hours was really good, and I was actually underfoiled for the first three and overfoiled for the last eight. In some ways, you know, I wish I'd waited for a better day, but just with the time frames and everything that lined up, it was the day that I had. And even then, I think I could have done further. I remember and a few sort of logistical things. I was a long way offshore, and on the east coast of Australia, if you watch Finding Nemo, you know what I'm talking about. There's the East Australian Current, the EAC, which Crush and all the turtles swim down in anyway, the East Australian Current goes from north to south, and when you're far enough offshore, you're going into the current. So I was out in head-high bumps, like maxed out on the 1099, and I was doing the slowest splits I'd ever done before. So I was doing like 18 kilometers per hour average. I then went in 2 kilometers closer to shore, and my splits went up to 22 k's an hour. That's I got crazy. Out of the current. So yeah. Little things like that make a big difference for when you're foiling for 11 hours. And I think I probably could have gotten closer to 250 kilometers, maybe 240 kilometers if I hadn't had the ordinary start and the current in the middle, and it was able to use a small foil for the rest of the run. So, but I think now that to me, the benchmark is if you can do 300 kilometers in 12 hours, that's the benchmark to me. That's what I'd, if I got the chance, that's what I'd be looking at trying to do. 300 Ks in 12 hours. So that's an average of 25 kilometers per hour, which is very doable now. You know, M2O, the guys that are winning are averaging over 30 kilometers per hour. So, you know, it could even be, I guess it's that 30 times 360 Ks in 12 hours is probably what, if you got really good conditions, is possible. But it, that's a pretty big day of not much rest and pushing hard, but possible. It's if you have the right conditions and the current, it's doable.
But like a title like that is important for your personal brand. But now that you're all set, because people know you, you're a big name. Are you still, do you still need something like that? Or is it just like the personal challenge that you see in something like that?
I think it's not so much about the brand, or it's the personal challenge for sure. It's like pushing yourself to be the best that you can be. And yeah, for sure. I think, if the opportunity arose and it was all set up, I'd go for it. But it's a big project to organize something like that. And if you are going to do it, you're probably going to try to get, you know, a bit of brand awareness to do it. It's something I'd like to do, but it's not the top of the priority list at the moment, that's for sure.
All right. Very nice. Well, James, thank you very much. We're almost at the hour. Is there anything else you want to address or tell the world?
Oh, I guess the only thing is recently, I guess a group of us have sort of launched the Downwind Foil World Tour, which exactly. is something that's pretty exciting. You know, it's been pretty well received to start with. And there's just been the two French races. The whole, I guess, idea of it is grow the sport. It's not so much about crowning a world champion or a world number one. It's about creating a bit of a form guide, giving news stories and podcasts and telling the story of the downwind foil races and the conditions and what downwind foiling is around the world. I think Hawaii is an epic, you know, month of July, and the racing that goes on there is awesome. But I'd love to be able to grow that in other places like Australia, like France, like the US mainland, like throughout Europe. I mean, there's so many places we can downwind foil. And the Downwind Foil World Tour is about growing the sport. It's not trying to replace Molokai Tua, who was a world championship. It's trying to use Molokai Tua as a world championship and show people that this can be done in places all over the world. And we can have races with 100 people everywhere. And it's an exciting little project. And me and a few mates have sort of started up. And definitely check out the Downwind Foil World Tour Instagram. And there's a web page. And Santroy Pay just finished up, and Kai Thompson has been crashing it, and he just won the Crozon Foil Festival Elite Downwind race last night. I believe there is another race that's going to go on more as like the sort of open, sort of not so elite downwind race. There's going to be more races going on. There's also the other races within the global sort of world tour is a few races in Perth, Western Australia. The West Coast Downwinder, which has had 50 or so competitors the last few years, and this year they've included the Doctor, which is a big surf ski race. It's probably the Molokai Tua Wahoo of the Australian sort of paddle scene. You start at Rottnest Island, you come back to the mainland of Australia. It's about a 30-kilometer downwind run, and it hasn't been available to foilers for the last few years, but it's always been the one that you want to win. And it's back on the calendar this year for foils, which is exciting. And then obviously Hawaii, finishing up in Hawaii with Maori to Molokai, Molokai to Oahu is to round it out. That's the global sort of world tour. And then there's going to be regional tours amongst that. So races, all the other races in Hawaii, like Palamua, the Voyager race.
That's still a work in progress. That's no date set yet, or is that fixed already? Is that a program that
for Hawaii, like M2O and M2M don't have dates for 2026 just yet. So the idea of the season is we start in France, Australia, and then finish in Hawaii to honor the Hawaiian sort of legacy as being the big ones that you want to win. And
yeah, also, that's the new season that just started now in Saint-Tropez and in Cozon.
That's the idea. And like you said, it's still kind of working itself out and a work in progress, but that's all we're running with for the first, I guess, season of it. And I think there's a few question marks as to why it starts in France, not Hawaii, because obviously July to November is a much more condensed season versus October to July is a lot longer. But the beauty is there's races that are happening regionally. There's a race in Barcelona. There's a bunch of races on the east coast of Australia. The Sydney Downwind Fall race, the Sunshine Coast Bump Hunters race just ran. There's races in Malibu.
Yeah, you have to talk about that as well. That was my last question, yeah.
There's races all over the world, you know, and I think to just think of downwind foiling as just those six races would be silly, but they're the six biggest races that I think best represent the most competitive races at this stage in the sport. But as new regional events sort of come up and prove themselves, there's no reason we couldn't add more in. It's just a balancing act on trying to represent all the regions. At this stage, Hawaii, Australia and France seem to have the most downwind foil races that are going to events, closely followed by Tahiti and the US mainland. And I think there's definitely space to have races in the US mainland and Tahiti as the sport grows more and more. It'd be great to have Hood River and that Malibu race as continue to grow and have some races in Tahiti. I think a lot of people would be stoked to get over there and sample the downwind bumps there. So it's just the beginning. And I think that as more people go to the events that are considered the big events and the sponsors put money towards those events and put their athletes towards those events and more eyes diverted towards those big events, I think it gives us more potential to grow into a bigger sport, more legitimate sport, and like a worldwide sport.
Very nice. So, as I said, last question was the bump hunters that Dave West, I don't know if he organized it or he helped organize it. How is that for you?
I actually didn't end up going to it. I planned to, but I was a bit crook. And I'd just gotten home from Fiji, so it was hard to sort of swing it by the family. I didn't go, but I heard it was a great race. They got some great conditions. Alex Tibby, actually from representing Code Foils, got the win. Perth Stanley was in second here from Sydney. And I can't even remember who got third now. But Trent Gordon got third, who was gunning for me. He was spewing I couldn't make because he wanted to kick my ass. Which was, I love the competition, the rivalries that the brew. So he'll have to wait to have a go at me till Perth, which would be exciting. But yeah, I was spewing I couldn't come to it, but it kind of feeling a bit nasally now, but I had a really bad sinus sort of thing going on. Right, okay. So yeah, it was a bummer, but there's plenty more to come.
All right. Well, thank you very much, James, for coming on the show, for taking your time. Again, I wish you that you get healthy, and I'm looking forward to all your content. I really enjoy it so much. Thanks so much. And for all the listeners, the viewers, if you've enjoyed this episode, head on over to my Patreon, which is down in the show notes. And see you guys in the next one. Thanks, man.
Thanks, Matt.
Cheers.